This weekend, the inaugural Saudi Arabian Grand Prix will take place in Jeddah. This is not the first addition to the Formula One calendar to have prompted controversy relating to the human rights record of the hosts. Races are currently held in China, Russia, Azerbaijan, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Qatar, and have been held previously in Brazil and Argentina under their juntas and South Africa under apartheid. If there has never been a North Korean Grand Prix, it may only be because Kim Jong-un has never inquired. Saudi Arabia's hosting of a Grand Prix is, like Saudi Arabia's recent acquisition of Premier League football club Newcastle United, an example of what has become known as sports washing. This is the process by which an unsavoury regime seeks to launder its image by associating itself, however crassly or absurdly, with the virtues the rest of us associate with athletes: courage, grace, and fair play. Hosting one of the great international events, a Formula One meeting, an Olympic Games, a World Cup, can enable the most cloistered and repressive tyranny to style itself a good global citizen, however many journalists they may recently have murdered, minorities they have imprisoned, migrant workers they have exploited. Everyone knows sports washing when they see it. None of the Formula One teams competing in Jeddah will be under any illusion about where they are or why. But does that mean they shouldn't have gone? Is there an argument that it might be a good thing that they have? Does sports washing, from the sports washer's perspective, actually work? This is the Foreign Desk.
States will try and use sport to improve their image and gain various forms of attractive power can really backfire. We've started to hear so much more in the last couple of months about Saudi Arabia's various human rights issues at home than before they acquired Newcastle. So does it really improve their image? In the short term, no.
Saudi officials in Saudi Arabia are very desperate right now to polish their image, especially after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So they're trying so hard to reshape the image of, especially of the crown prince, to basically attach his image to sports and to entertainment, so people will not be thinking about human rights abuses.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined first of all by Dr. Paul Michael Branigan, Senior Lecturer in Sport Management and Policy at Manchester Metropolitan University. Paul is also the author of Qatar and the 2022 FIFA World Cup, Politics, Controversy, Change. Paul, let's start with the term, sports washing. Is there by now an absolutely solid, universally understood definition of it?
Well, I think, Andrew, you would certainly think so, given how much sports washing has sort of been tossed around both, you know, academia, but particularly the media. My answer to that would probably be no. Certainly from an academic perspective, I think it's conceptually very, very weak. And it's actually become a bit of a buzz term that doesn't really do very much. I think also, particularly in academic circles, there's an awful lot of hesitancy to use the term sports washing, really, because a lot of the time actually using sport to wash one's image never really works. It's like washing your laundry with sort of dirty water, as it were. And I think also to somewhat confuse issues, there's been an awful lot of other concepts thrown around in academia and the media, which probably explain the same thing, whether that be nation branding, whether it be using sport for what we call soft power. Essentially, it's all part of that sort of mix of countries or cities trying to use sport to improve their image. So for me, it's still quite a hazy concept and term.
Is it maybe useful to think of sports washing as that thing a country does in the hope of distracting people from how awful it is, as opposed to those more familiar uses of sport, especially Olympic Games and World Cups, to try and make everybody think of a country's virtues, to make the country look good?
Look, I mean, I think there's a number of things going on here. I think, first of all, you know, particularly things like the World Cup, the Olympic Games, Formula One, whatever it may be, these sports are now going to new lands. So we've got the first Middle Eastern World Cup next year. Qatar is now hosting the Formula One. Saudi Arabia has recently hosted Formula One. These big sports events are going to new lands, and particularly areas and regions that don't really share that more sort of Western version of democracy. But I think, yeah, certainly, I think there is a real difference. I mean, if you look at any Olympic Games host or World Cup host, whether it be the UK, South Africa, Brazil, they will all use World Cups and various tournaments to improve their image and attract others. But I think what we really usually mean by sports washing, which differentiates this, is that where countries already have a negative image, will try and position themselves more positively and get away from that negative image by cuddling up to sports values, sports passion, and the various sort of nationalism excitement that we love so much about sport.
Is it therefore as straightforward, if we think of sports washing as something that is done mostly by countries who are aware that they already have a pretty poor image in a lot of the world, when they go about doing this, is it as straightforward as, for example, the Saudis thinking, well, if we buy Newcastle United and host a Grand Prix, everybody will forget about the time we chopped up that journalist?
No, I certainly don't think it is. And actually, I think a concept I've coined, which is soft disempowerment, which is states will try and use sport to improve their image and gain various forms of attractive power, can really backfire. Newcastle is a great example. Saudi Arabia purchased there. We've started to hear so much more in the last couple of months about Saudi Arabia's various human rights issues at home than before they acquired Newcastle. So does it really improve their image? In the short term, no. However, I do think potentially long-term engagement in these various sports clubs and events does have the potential to improve the image of certain countries. If Newcastle win a Premier League in a couple of seasons' time, I very much doubt that at the forefront of Newcastle's fans' minds will be the human rights issues in Saudi. I think they will be overjoyed by the fact they've won a Premier League and will probably look upon the Saudi owners in very, very favourable terms. I think rather than actually being just about improving one's image and trying to brush under the carpet one's human rights issues, I think sport really is seen very much by a lot of countries as a universal language. And I think a lot of the time hosting a Formula One, owning a football club, hosting a World Cup or Olympics is really used by certain countries to remind international audiences that there's a shared passion there. We look at, for example, Qatar. Qatar's World Cup plan is much, much longer term. And what it's really trying to do is open the communication gates between East and West, but really remind Western audiences in particular that we do have something in common with the Qataris, this passion and love for football. So, you know, why can't we all just come together and enjoy this event?
Is part of it as well just the cynical understanding that sports fans are just hopelessly sentimental saps who will pretty much find a way to justify anything to themselves if they think it's going to do their preferred team some good?
Yeah, I think so. And I think these countries are certainly looking to somewhat hide behind that excitement. We see this all the time with corporations. There's no secret why companies like McDonald's or Coca-Cola want to host World Cups. They want to cuddle up to the great values of sport, to the role models that are sports stars and everything else. And I think these countries are looking to do exactly the same. They are looking to cuddle up to sports and really try and tap into audiences' emotions. You look at sport, for example, it's one of the great mediums we have as reflections of our own selves. And I think what's really trying to happen here is these countries are trying to become part of that reflection of ourselves.
But to come back to a point you were making earlier, does it actually work from the point of view of the sports washers?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think that's a key thing there, I think, is asking if this actually works. Because, of course, there is a real great deal of irony here. These countries want to host these Formula One circuits, these World Cups, to use them as a stage to improve their image and really as a platform. But of course, what it also does is provide the global media with a platform through which to pressure governments to highlight various countries and states' issues at home, and in doing so, try and pressure them. Great example I use my students is how many people had heard of the kafala sponsorship system before Qatar got the World Cup. This is a system that's been in place for decades across all of the Arabian Gulf. So there's a real irony here in trying to improve their image through sport. What actually tends to happen, particularly in the short term, is they actually suffer from an awful lot more disempowerment than they do actual empowerment on the world stage.
Is there an argument, and again thinking about how the sports washers might see this, that there's a certain amount of good old-fashioned Western hypocrisy going on when we talk about sports washing? Is it one of those things of, you know, we are projecting our soft power, you are sports washing?
I certainly think so. And I think the crucial thing there to remember is that states who have poor human rights records should rightly be scrutinized by governing bodies, by other countries, by the media. But the actual criteria for issues around human rights is, of course, very, very much a Western discourse. And it's very much this Western idea of democracy and human rights that these non-Western countries are being judged on. And, you know, look, let's be brutal honest, no matter what country it is hosting these events, they are doing so for their own gain. They are doing so to improve their image, whether that be the UK's hosting of the 2012 Olympic Games or Qatar's hosting of the 2022 World Cup. You know, the motive and the objective is still the same, albeit it might be for various different outcomes.
It's not something that is likely to happen, but would it completely undermine the power and the point of sports washing if, for example, a particular superstar player did a bit of reading about the conditions of workers in Qatar and decided they didn't want to play at Qatar's World Cup? Or if indeed had one particular driver decided ahead of this weekend that that's a bridge too far, I'm not going to race in Jeddah?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting issue and position through which athletes are in. We have seen some murmurs from various football teams. I believe it was the Swedish team most recently who were standing up for the human rights issues in Qatar. And of course, there has been a lot of talk about will countries eventually boycott Qatar. And of course, as we've seen with Lewis Hamilton and his stance on LGBT, particularly leading up to the Qatar Formula One a few weekends ago as well. But athletes also have to be very, very careful here. Athletes, when you speak to them, essentially, particularly during their athletic career, are mainly focused on winning. You know, that is their job. It's one of the most difficult things they can do. So they are so focused on that. So whether or not they take certain issues along the way, obviously, remains to be seen. But again, it's a big question for sport. I mean, one argument would be if these governing bodies, the FIA and FIFA, are awarding these countries the tournaments, should athletes be the ones to actually, you know, raise their voices here? Or should it be the governing bodies who actually, you know, are the ones who lead the way in terms of deciding whether or not countries should host these tournaments based on their various social and political issues at home?
Just as a final thought then, I guess let's try and weigh that equation against one other upcoming event which is already attracting accusations of sports washing. That is, of course, the Winter Olympics due to be held in China in February. From China's point of view, though, assuming the Winter Olympics goes off successfully on its own merits, will it still have been worthwhile for them to have done it?
I think a really crucial there, and also I can point here to Qatar again next year, is how well the tournament is organised and delivered. So if you look at, for example, one of the most successful global sports events we've had in recent years in terms of organisation has been Russia 2018. It went off without a hitch. It was very, very well organised. But prior to Russia 2018, there was an awful lot of scrutiny, threats of boycott, particularly with Russia's LGBT discrimination and various laws at home. So I think it really, really depends on how the event's organised. I mean, what we tend to see with all of these events is leading up to the tournament, global media, politicians will focus on the broader social politics of the country. During the event, the focus is on the sport. And post-event, the focus is on how successful the organisation of that event was.
Paul, thank you. That was Dr. Paul Michael Branigan of Manchester Metropolitan University. You're listening to The Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. At this point, let's take a look at the kind of thing Saudi Arabia is hoping to sports wash. Joining me now from San Francisco is Arij Al-Sadhan, a human rights campaigner who has been advocating for the release of her brother, Abdulrahman Al-Sadhan, since he was detained by Saudi authorities in March 2018 for criticising the kingdom on social media. On the 5th of October this year, a Saudi appeals court upheld the 20-year prison sentence imposed on Abdulrahman, an aid worker by trade, as well as a 20-year travel ban after his release. Arish, first of all, bring us up to date with the latest developments in your brother's case. What do you know now about where he is and how he's being treated?
My brother Abdurrahman is still held incommunicado, so he is barred from any communication, whether with his family or with his legal representatives. No visits, no calls are allowed at all. Last we know that he is in solitary confinement in Al Hayer prison, and he's been there for a long, long time, barred from any communication with the outside world. And he suffered some severe torture at some point where he ended up in the ICU intensive care unit, where his hand got broken. But as far as we know, he is still in solitary confinement. And we're terribly concerned about his safety and his well-being and health, because his health has also been severely deteriorating since after all the torture and mistreatment and being in solitary confinement for a long, long time.
Do you have any contact at all with the Saudi authorities?
Unfortunately, the Saudi authorities, since MBS came to power, all the traditional channels people in Saudi Arabia used to go to is completely shut down or closed. So we tried sending faxes, writing letters, phone calls, all different forms of where we can usually be able to communicate with Saudi officials is not working, and we're completely being ignored. We tried to reach out to the Saudi embassy here in the US, and we've been ignored for over a year until the US government started to condemn the abuses publicly. They got a very short response even before the hearing started, saying basically, of course, confirming that he's detained and saying that he is fine, that he is safe, and that he is being visited and no human rights abuse is being done, and which is completely false.
I think we've established there why it is that Saudi Arabia might feel its reputation needs an amount of cleansing. But the reason we're doing this show this weekend is that it is, of course, the weekend of the first Saudi Grand Prix. What image does it strike you that Saudi Arabia is trying to sell the world through this and other sporting endeavors?
Yeah, so Saudi officials in Saudi Arabia are very desperate right now to polish their image, especially after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and after several cases became public, like my brother's case and many others. So they're trying so hard to reshape the image, especially of the crown prince, to basically attach his image to sports and to entertainment, so people will not be thinking about human rights abuses.
Thinking of the Saudi Grand Prix this weekend, would it have made any difference in your case or other such cases if, for example, one Formula One driver at least had just said, I don't want to go, I'm not going to race in Saudi?
Yeah, absolutely. It would send a strong message to Saudi Arabia that they cannot accept human rights abuses and they cannot accept to basically cover up and whitewash the human rights abuses. And it definitely will help in pressuring to create real reforms, real changes for the people of Saudi Arabia and to improve the human rights on the long run.
So is there an argument then that things like the Saudi Grand Prix or other similar events do actually provide you and other critics, other activists, with actually more of a platform? I mean, again, it occurs to me that the very fact that there is a Grand Prix in Jeddah this weekend is the reason we're doing this program, which is not going to end up being an advertisement for Saudi Arabia.
Yes, absolutely. But it's actually counterproductive right now because the abuses are so bad and it's so fresh and it's still out there. So the more they try to cover up those abuses with events like that, the media, the activists, the NGOs are going to continue to speak up and speak out more and more about these abuses. And even the celebrities or the sport people, they'll be under the spotlight for basically supporting an abuser who murdered a journalist. Still, there is no justice for Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Our lives are in danger on a daily basis. So definitely it puts a lot of pressure and a lot of attention on the cases of human rights abuses and also on the what stand actually those celebrities are taking to condemn those abuses.
One of the curiosities of the sports washing phenomenon, apart from the fact that it may even be counterproductive from the sports washer's point of view, is that a regime like the regime in Saudi Arabia very often conducts itself like it really doesn't care in the slightest what anybody else thinks of it. Whereas the fact that they do something like hold, for example, A Formula One meeting suggests that they do very much care what other people think of it. Does that possibility give you any hope that maybe that there is a way that the Saudis can be pressured either through this means or others into being more moderate, being more reasonable, and perhaps even one day releasing your brother?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a hope as long as we are speaking up. And actually, the only way we have right now is to condemn and to increase the pressure and to speak up. Everyone can contribute and help in that. And the Saudi officials do care a lot about their image. And that's why they are using sports and entertainment to polish their image. All the reforms and the changes that have been advertised are always attached to the Crown Prince's image, not to actually support the people. The reforms, or what's so-called reforms, it hasn't reflected anything positive on the people of Saudi Arabia so far. People are still suffering from poverty, no jobs, people are being kicked out of their homes. There is no real reforms while there is no freedom of speech. If people cannot speak, then those reforms are not serving the people.
Just as a final thought then, why do you think it is, and I'm not holding you in any way responsible for the decisions that the Saudi regime makes, but if they are so concerned about their reputation and they are concerned about what people think of them, why don't, instead of holding Formula One meetings, they actually address the things that people criticize them for?
Because it's been always that way in Saudi Arabia. So far, unfortunately, they cannot think in an innovative way. And they are actually scared of giving people the right to speak freely. They cannot stand criticism. And with MBS especially, he cannot stand any sort of criticism at all. Any sort of criticism, even just to criticize Vision 2030 or any project, it will be taken as a personal insult to him, and whoever dares to criticize will be imprisoned and tortured and will actually suffer some severe consequences.
Arish, thank you. That was the human rights campaigner Arish Al-Saddan. You can find out more about the campaign to free Abdulrahman Al-Saddan by heading to freesaddan.org. Do stay with us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. It is the athletes who often find themselves awkward accessories to sports washing. Ahead of the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, reigning Formula One world champion Lewis Hamilton spoke of his discomfort at competing and claimed it wasn't his choice. Hamilton said, however, that he would wear the same rainbow-striped helmet he had in Qatar in support of LGBTQ+ rights, a gesture that, for any Saudi citizen, could only be undertaken at risk of arrest. Well, joining me now from Toronto is Bruce Kidd, an Emeritus Professor of Sport and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. Bruce is also a former distance runner who represented Canada at the 1964 Olympic Games in Tokyo and is a two-time British Empire and Commonwealth Games medalist. Bruce, as I understand it, you have some reservations about the term sports washing itself.
Yes, I do, because I don't think it tells us anything significant. Throughout human history, governments, powerful individuals, corporations have supported sport, have financed sport for all kinds of reasons, one of which is to strengthen their legitimacy. In the 1960s, when I was running as an amateur, the only sponsors of sport were polluters, tobacco companies, alcohol companies, anybody who wanted to clean up their image. So there's not a lot of traction in the term. Secondly, it assumes that sport is an innocent victim of these practices, when in fact, sport seeks these agreements to improve its own image and legitimacy, to take away the horrible reputation of scandals or abuse and so on. So to suggest that it's a nefarious practice that only governments that are seeking legitimacy engage in is, I think, to misrepresent the totality over time and many different societies of these patronage, sponsoring, advertising relationships.
Do you think the practice that you're talking about, though, has evolved at all in recent years? If you think back to when you were competing, was this a conversation that ever went on among athletes about whether their was any question about whether you should compete in certain countries or in certain circumstances?
Well, there was those questions, but there are other relationships too. I think that the corporate sponsorship of sport over the last 50 years has grown exponentially. In the political category, it's been a question of long-standing concern in societies and certainly among sports persons, going well back to the 1920s and even before. In my country and in both of yours, there were extensive debates in 1935 and 1936 about whether Olympic athletes should compete in the Olympic Games in Nazi Germany. I would say they go in waves. During the Cold War period, they were intense at times. Then in the 80s, after the Los Angeles boycott, they tapered off, and now they're being raised again.
As a former athlete yourself, what view do you take of athletes now who decide that it's okay, that they'll go and compete in Saudi Arabia or Qatar or China or Russia or wherever else? Are you sympathetic to them on the basis that most athletes have a very, very limited time in their lives at which they will be able to compete at the highest level and it's not their fault where these events get scheduled? Or do you think that they do have a wider responsibility?
First of all, I'm sympathetic to them when they're being asked to give up opportunities and everybody else is engaging with those states. There is pressure on athletes to stay home from the Winter Olympics in Beijing next year at a time when in Canada, trade with China is at record highs, when colleges and universities draw their largest single source of revenue from international students, many, if not most of whom come from China. So it's business as usual, except for athletes. And I share the resentment because of that. Secondly, there is an older ambition with international sport that you play with other people despite the very real political, ideological, religious, economic, and other differences. And that you try to make sport an avenue for peaceful, honest, frank intercultural exchange as a way of getting to know people from different societies, helping to understand them, and as a group, contribute to a current in civil society that would argue for dialogue and understanding as a way of resolving conflicts rather than going to war. That ambition is sometimes opportunistically trotted out at times like this by National Olympic Committees, the IOC, and other bodies. I have in my life believed that there's both importance to it, that it is a lived experience for many athletes, and that it's worth pursuing. I worry about how you decide with whom you're going to compete and not compete. It's not only Russia, China, and Saudi Arabia, but as I read about the terrible things happening in the United States and the number of states that are overturning democratic requirements for voting and the number of states that are outlawing abortion, becoming misogynist states, I worry about whether or not we should be competing in the United States. And then there are other countries that are engaging in really objectionable practices. In terms of Beijing, I am arguing that we go, but we go with our eyes open and we go prepared to talk about these issues rather than burying them and forcing athletes to shut up, as happened previously, most recently in Sochi and the 2008 Olympics.
Do you think then it is more incumbent on the sporting authorities, whether it is Formula One or the IOC or whoever, to outline and adhere to some standards of behaviour for prospective host nations?
I certainly support that. When I was a member of the bid committee in Toronto for 2008, the IOC made us guarantee the price of hotel rooms 8 years ahead of time as part of our bid. So there should be other conditions too. And I think as we're moving closer to an international consensus on human rights, they should be part of those expectations. But we're not there yet. And the question is how to get from here to there. And if we want to keep the world together in sport, they have to be negotiated in an open and frank way. I think the Canadians who go to Beijing need to be fully informed about what the issues are, and there needs to be guarantees from the Canadian Olympic Committee and the IOC that if they choose to speak out, if they choose to engage in frank conversations with their Chinese hosts, that they will be protected, and that it's the Olympic Charter that governs those Beijing venues, not Chinese law.
On that thought, is the way forward where we are now then, potentially just to try and take advantage of whatever opportunities there are to have those wider conversations, to express that kind of dissent? Because it doesn't seem axiomatic that these countries holding global events is inevitably going to open them up. China has not become a less repressive place since hosting the Summer Olympics in 2008.
Well, I think the first step, as the athletes have been demanding during the last couple of years, is to realize the full right of free expression during Olympic Games and in all aspects of the Olympic movement. I think the second big question for the world is this very urgently relevant question that you ask about whether international sport should insist upon standards of behavior for host nations. We're moving from a century or more of respect for the principle of non-intervention in the affairs of host nations. We're moving towards the principle of the right to protect, the right of the international community to intervene in repressive nations, to protect citizens, and to demand a minimum compliance with human rights. And we've got to accelerate that effort in international sport. These efforts should intensify, and we should take advantage of the presence of the Olympics in Paris in 24, Austria in 26, LA in 28, and so on, to really institutionalize standards of respect for human rights in host nations. And I'm really grateful to you and your program for raising these questions. I hope that the media and others keep their feet to the fire until it's fully realized.
That was the Olympian Bruce Kidd of the University of Toronto. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. Do also keep an eye out for the final installment of this season of The Big Interview, in which I speak to the legendary West Indian cricketer Michael Holding. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.